Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hej!
Hej, oj, kanon.
Du säger alltid hej. Ja. Jag säger hej och välkomna till Vinpratarna.
Ett nytt avsnitt, härligt, ett vinmakaravsnitt.
Precis.
Och vi sitter idag på Winechails kontor på Södermalm.
Väldigt mysigt. Ja. Det är liksom det gråa.
Vi sitter och tittar på det gråa januari, liksom. Men det är härligt, ändå härligt, härligt ljus. Och här sitter vi och ska precis till att prata med Anna Martens.
Precis.
Från Vin och Diana.
Och det är lite kul för att vi binder ihop säcken lite. För vi har ju precis pratat om Sicilien och lite olika liksom regioner och vinstilar och sådär.
Mm.
Så nu får vi lite mer djupgående från Anna då som håller till på Etna.
Ja, exakt. Och det spännande med det är ju att, vilket hon också pratar om lite senare, att det är så många små producenter som ju har poppat upp runt på Sicilien och just Etna. Och i hennes fall handlar det om 6 hektar och 40 000 flaskor om året. Men att det finns ett intresse och det finns en marknad och, det, och framförallt är det förbannat bra viner.
Mm.
Superspännande person.
Och mysig.
Mm, mysig och vältalig.
Precis, ja, hon är ju från Australien så att engelskan är perfekt.
Ja, exakt.
Det är skönt.
Ja, så njut av detta. Anna Martens från Vino Diana. Okay, so here we are now with Anna Martens. Is that the right?
Yeah,
yes. Is that right? Okay,
welcome.
From Vino Diana.
Thank you.
Welcome to Vinpratarna
and
to Sweden. Yeah. We for starters, could you just tell us a little bit about your background? Because now you're working in Sicily, but you're from Australia.
Yes.
So what's been your path? What brought you?
Okay, well, I'll tell you the brief story rather than the long story. So yes, I'm Australian from Adelaide, and I've been living on Etna now for 10 years, making wine, originally for someone else, and I created Vino Diana with my husband Eric Nario, who's French, in 2010. And before that, I used to work in Tuscany for about 7 years, and then in Australia. Always in the wine industry. I've been doing harvests and working in vineyards in the winery for, oh, now 23 years. So
okay.
Showing my age.
Where in Australia did you start off?
I lived in Adelaide, and so I went to Roseworthy College at the time and the University of Adelaide. And I was a bit of a geek, so I actually did quite a lot of research with the Australian Wine Research Institute. And I worked 8 years at Petaluma in the Adelaide Hills.
Cool.
So I did everything there, from in the laboratory to a little bit in the vineyards, but at that stage it was very much winemaking and in the cellar. The two were quite separated in the Australian industry in the 90s. This is in the 90s. So.
And what made you leave Australia and travel to Italy? And
I think us Australians, we always love to travel. So, you know, I had the opportunity whilst working at Petaluma, as soon as I finished my studies in oenology and viticulture, to do harvest, you know, initially in Burgundy. I spent some time in Oregon. I came to Italy initially just to sort of see the classic region, spend some time in Tuscany, Piedmont, and In France the same. I spent about a month traveling around France, and I loved it. So when I could, you know, I chose to leave Australia and start to do harvest in the southern hemisphere and then in the northern hemisphere. So from Argentina, I then go to the France, and then I went to New Zealand, and then I went to the north of Italy. So I traveled backwards and forwards. And
so it's nice to be at one place right now.
Yeah, but you know, this is when you're, you know, late 20s, and you know, you're single, life's good. It's it's just fabulous, and the wine industry is, you know, amazing.
Yeah. Cool. So you're based in Etna now.
Yes.
So can you just describe a little bit for our listeners what kind of place Etna is?
Could we just start with maybe why did you end up in Sicily?
Okay.
Because I mean, why did you sort of,
why did I end up in Sicily? When I was working in Tuscany, I worked with my colleague who was from Palermo. So I started to go on holiday with her down to Sicily, and I just loved it. And it felt, being Australian, I felt a lot of similarities between Australia with an island, the landscape, the sea, the people. It was very open, very different from my experience in Tuscany. And then I had some amazing bottles of wine from Etna, and Eric is a wine importer in the UK. So initially we went there on to actually Etna on holiday for me, but for him to look for some wines. And, you know, it was just extraordinary. Just such dynamic landscape, the volcano, these old vineyards. And I said, I need to come to Sicily. I need to leave Tuscany and not just Sicily, Etna specifically. It took me a few years. I was working in South Africa before, you know, I looked for some work, but I wasn't quite ready to do my own project on Etna. I realized it's a very complex volcano, and so I wanted to work for someone as an oenologist. So that took me a few years to find that position, and then I was fortunate.
Okay, cool.
So, same question. How would you describe Etna? You described a little bit now with the volcanic landscape, etc. But what makes Etna special if you compare with other parts of Sicily?
Yes, because when people sort of say, oh, you make wines in Sicily, and you know, me, I'm not local, but if you're from Etna, you say, no, I make wines from Etna. Mm-hmm. They make a big differentiation between, you know, Sicily and Etna. I mean, Etna is a world to its own. The energy of the volcano, the climate is very extreme, the soils are amazing. You know, every time you drive, it's you know, such a contrast between seeing the sea, seeing the mountains, the other side, which are very beautiful, and then, you know, these black lava, and you know, these lava flows that are still very evident 100 years later, and then these tiny little vineyards, you know, on these terraces, so many abandoned, and then the wildlife is extraordinary. You know, all the flowers that are there different times of the year. It's really dramatic.
We need to go soon.
Definitely. Yeah.
Every time we try the wines from Etna, it's like, we need to go.
Definitely need to go. I've been there once, I told you about it, but just on vacation, so we need to go to wine trip.
And Sicily is amazing. I mean, Sicily is very big, and each region is very different. You know, the food that we eat is different from what you eat down in Pacino. It's different from what you eat in Vittoria. It's very different from what you eat in Trapani. I mean, you know, there's so many influences on the island from all the invasions, and you know, that for me, that's really fascinating. I wasn't expecting that diversity in how the people look, but the architecture, but definitely reflected in the cuisine.
Yeah.
So when you came to Etna, you started to look for vineyards. How was that process? Is it easy to find? Because you have some old vineyards, right?
Yes, yes. When I came to Etna, I was working for Andrea Franchetti at Passo Pisciaro. And initially, I just wanted, because I wasn't sure whether Etna was the place for Eric and I, or we weren't sure to make wine. So, you know, the first few years were just spent with Andrea, who's a very generous person, and, you know, I spent not a lot of time. Well, I spent time in the cellar, but I wanted to discover all the different contrada, all the different vineyards. And he has some amazing vineyards, because he was one of the first to invest into Etna and to bottle wine. So it took a few years to find the vineyard that we, you know, first purchased in 2010. Is it easy? It's not easy. It's quite complicated because, one, often it's difficult to find who owns the vineyard, because a lot of people, particularly on Etna, migrated either to the States or to Australia after the Second World War. So maybe, and the vineyard's often been subdivided and in very, you know, different names. So that can be complicated. And now it's also very expensive. So you might find this amazing piece, but, you know, people want, instead of once 15 years ago, 5,000 euro, it's now 100,000 euro.
Okay.
So it's not like, you know, we're not rich people. It's not like we've got, you know, let's go and buy this hectare. It's kind of like we drive around all the time looking for tiny little plots, and then we try and work out, okay, you know, how much money do we think we need? And, you know, can we find the owner?
But tell us about the estate then. I mean, how the size of it, and what varieties you have, and what kind of soil you have on the estate.
Well, we are increasing. So since 2010, now we own nearly 6 hectares, and that's divided between I need to count actually at least 6 different properties. Sometimes the property is just a third of a hectare, and then last year we bought 2 beautiful properties. One's just under a hectare that's planted. And with over 120 olive trees that are over 100 years old. So we make some olive oil now by default, but that's a different world, but that's exciting. And then there's another property very high up above the 1,000-meter road that we are starting to plant. And so, yeah, altogether 6 hectares.
Six hectares. And what grape variety?
The grape variety, we only work... Well, we've chosen to buy old vineyards, except these 2 plots of land. Is Nerello Mascalese, principally. And then in the old vineyards, because some of the vineyards have 80 to 100 years old, there's a little bit of Nerello Cappuccio and Alicante.
Mm-hmm.
And Alicante is Grenache, but locally they refer to it as Alicante. And then there's a sprinkling of white in these old vineyards, so things like Catarato, Minella, there's a big bunch of white grapes they call Uva Francese, to be a little bit ruder, and there's a tiny bit of Caricante as well, but and Gricanico. So a little Gricanico.
So overfilled.
So it depends on the wines, but the higher you go, and it depends exactly on the contrada, the lava flow that you are, you know, the blend that people planted. You know, one area is a little bit more Grenache or Alicante, another little area is a little bit more white in the vineyard.
That's cool.
But, you know, literally every vineyard is a base of 85% Nerello Mascalese. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What would you say? What is your sort of wine making philosophy? What kinds of wines do you want to do?
I mean, we're very organic in how we've grown, and we're very sort of organic and in the wines that we make. I mean, we didn't set out with a strict idea, Eric and I, let's make this style of wine, do this type of vinification in this type of vessel. It kind of, well, we're constantly sort of changing and evolving depending on what we're drinking, depending on what the vineyards are giving us. The more we understand the vineyards, we understand what manipulation we should do or we shouldn't. Very hands-off. We're quite lazy in the cellar. We try to do minimal amount of work. And we do a lot of work in the vineyard. So we're after something that is expressive of the terroir, something that has a purity of fruit, a wine that generally has a nice tension and acidity. And the soils of Etna always give this crazy minerality and salinity if you allow it. So we try not, we don't use new oak, we don't use small oak. We don't want to cover it, you know, any of this beautiful fruit. And Nerello Mascalese is a very versatile grape that you can make like a light fruity red. You can make something a little bit more rustic. Or, you know, you really can work it and do a lot of remontage and delestage. And you can make a dark brooding red if you want to, and a lot of alcohol. So we play around depending on the vineyard. And but now I think, you know, we make 6 different reds, and we've, in the past 6 years, worked out what each of those wines, you know, are, you know, from the vineyard. And... but that said, who knows, next year we might do something different.
But while you're talking about it, I mean, the first vintage, how was that? Were you happy with it from the start, or I mean, could you describe
the first vintage,
the evolution of the
yeah that we actually made for Vino Diana? It was just 600 bottles made in a plastic tub. I bought grapes from, I was working for Andrea Franchetti at the time, and I bought grapes from one of the cellar hands from his father's property, and from this other old gentleman that Andrea was buying part of the grapes from the vineyard and about to purchase the vineyard, and I was helping him with the vineyard work, and so I bought a percentage. And we decided at that stage, I was drinking a lot of wines from the Loire and from Burgundy and from the Jura. I'd seen a lot of whole bunch vinification. So we decided to throw 100% whole bunch into this plastic tub called a Mastellone. And everyone thought I was mad. Yeah, I mean, traditionally, that's what how Nerello was worked. But no, you know, people were... Everyone know you have to destem it, you have to extract it. And I was trending that with Andrea's wines, but our wines, we decided, no, 100% whole bunch. I didn't have a lot of time to focus on this Mastellone. So every morning I would jump in, a quick foot pigeage. Every evening when I left or I came to do some fermentation, I'd do a quick pigeage. And after about 3 weeks, I sort of thought, okay, let's press this. So, yeah, it was kind of, let's see what happens. And half the wine, we didn't know whether to add sulfur or not. So I added a small amount to half the wine, 300 bottles, which we bottled by hand. And the other half, we didn't add sulfur. And, you know, at one stage I thought, I'm not even sure we're going to bottle this wine.
Okay.
I mean, it was quite wild. There was quite a high VA. Sure. It was, you know, kind of left to its own devices. And it amazes me. I only sold it in Italy. It amazes me the number of people that still today call me or write me an email. Wow, I had a bottle of your 2008, your first wine. It's delicious. I mean, it's so, wow. Something
cool.
Worked.
Yeah, but, cool.
So we tried some of your wines yesterday, and mm-hmm. you have one, the Palmento,
yes.
The little bit brighter, lighter red
yes.
wine. And that was an ancient method, the Palmento.
Yes, the Palmento is the traditional wine building, a beautiful sort of structure in lava stone that has sort of a series inside of you know, making the wine in a top sort of like a lager. Whole bunches of grapes foot trodden by the family, and then you have two taps, and the must, you know, goes down by gravity to a little cement vat underneath. And then originally there used to be a beautiful massive piece of wood and a press inside. So this building, the Palmento, exists for over 300 years. And just on Etna, down in the south, in Paquito, and I've been told there are some around Napoli.
Okay.
Really?
But it's very common. I mean, sort of, not every family, but it was a very common thing.
It was where the wine was made. There was no such thing as a winery. That was the winery. Yeah. Everything, all the grapes were taken there. When we bought the property, we didn't, the ruin, the Palmento itself was a ruin. The walls were still there, but there was no roof. It was, you know, part of the vinification area was intact. And then the rest we actually restored how it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then the vineyards that the grapes that, you know, once would have been fermented in the vineyards, had some of them had been abandoned, some of them houses had been planted. So houses had been built on the vineyards. So no one had used it for about 60 years.
Okay.
But traveling around, I saw other people making wines in their family Palmento.
Yeah.
So
it's a lovely story.
Yeah, it is. But you also told us that there were some EU regulations that made you have to rebuild it inside as
well.
Unfortunately,
you're still not meant to make wines legally in the Palmento because the grapes are going on raw lava stone, and the EU has decided that's not safe for our health. And you should either line it with cement or glass or resin. But I believe this will change.
Yeah.
More people are putting money in because it's quite a big job to restore the Palmento. But
it's organic material.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
There's absolutely no reason why not. Mm. So, you know, people are starting to use it and put their wines in bottle. Initially, we were under the radar, but now they know we bottle and we make this wine in the Palmento. So we just had to do a few modifications, a little bit of stainless steel, a lid, and we know when they're going to come and visit. They're quite generous, the authorities, at time to let you know in advance. So you make sure you're not fermenting the grapes in that part of the Palmento.
That's cool. And the wine itself was also very interesting, since it was sort of a mix between white and red varieties.
Yes, yeah. Yes. It's a field blend of the grapes from around the house. So we're about 700 meters, and the vineyards there traditionally are planted with, you know, sometimes as much as 6-7% white.
Mm-hmm.
So you pick everything and you throw it into the palmento, and then just a very short maceration, 2-3 days. Depending, if the fermentation hasn't started, we might leave it 3 days, 4 days, a little bit longer than other people. But the idea is to make a wine that's quite light in colour. You then, once it's been pressed, ferment it in an old wooden foudre.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's meant to be drunk within the year. It's meant to be a vino da contadino, a peasant farmer's wine.
It's quite very light, refreshing, and
it reminds me of like a darker rosé almost.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was really, great.
I loved it.
Mm.
It should be drunk. Sort of quite cool on a
absolutely. On a summer, often half an hour in the bottle, or in the fridge before. Yeah. And last night we drank a magnum of it on the table, and it's a glue wine. it's fun.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And you also make, just to move on to another ancient method, because mm-hmm. you make some wines in amphora
mm-hmm.
as well. That's also very interesting because it's starting to be very popular.
Yes.
Yeah, sort of trendy.
Could you just explain, because I can imagine that not a lot of people have tried wines that are aged in amphora. What happens with the wines?
Okay. So we make wines in clay vessels that come from Georgia called cueveri. So they're like an amphora in regards that they're made of clay, but they're different in shape. The cueveri have a much sort of rounded belly and come down to a point, which is quite important. And you have to bury them in the ground, the cueveri. They won't stand upright. Whereabouts an amphora, you can have above ground or underground. Mm. That's someone's choice. So in Georgia, we've seen, they're buried underground. And then you may have a smaller vessel, an amphora, that you take the wine to the table in.
Okay.
So for in Georgia, there's a very distinct, for them, the amphora is the wine to the table to serve with. And the cueveri is what you're vinifying in.
Okay, cool.
Mm.
Did you say it was cement?
It's a clay.
Clay.
So it's clay that's come from, there's only a few cueveri makers left, and we work with someone called Zalico that has sourced the clay high up in the Caucasian Mountains and has this, he's been making these cueveri in his family for generations. He was nearly going out of business, and so luckily he's a very busy man now because, there's a few wonderful people like John Wooderman that have really been spreading the word of Georgian wines and the cueveri as this wonderful... neutral vessel, but that gives the wine a lot of lovely tension and energy. Back to your question. And so, you know, Zeliko is a very busy man. He's got orders now for years, because he can only make a certain number of quaveries depending on the humidity.
Okay.
It takes at least a week to fire them. He has to build an oven with bricks and leave them in there. So, you know, it's not like he can produce thousands each year.
No.
And it's him and his sons. But they're made by hand, you know, actually sort of, you know, the clay goes around and around and around and builds it up to a certain height, then gets on a ladder to build them even bigger. But it's quite extraordinary.
How many liters do they...
The first one, the biggest we have is 2,000 litres.
Yeah.
The smallest, we always argue, we're not 100% sure because we don't have any way to measure it, but we think is about 700 litres.
Okay.
Okay.
So quite huge.
Yeah, yeah. So you need a certain volume of grapes, and often you ferment the grapes because we destem the grapes but leave them on the skins for, you know, different periods of time in the bigger quaveries. And then, you know, once you've pressed them, you've got less new wine, and that goes to the smaller quavery. For 6 months, a year. So you need a series of quavery to really make the wine only in clay.
Okay. But take us through the process a little bit more in detail then. You harvest and then you put them straight into the bigger quavery.
Yes. So everything's hand harvested. We have to work all the vineyards by hand. There's no chance to use a tractor because they're all terraces and quite small terraces. So the cassettes, we do the sorting in the vineyard. If there's anything moldy or if hail has hit a vineyard, which can happen quite often on Etna. And then we take the grapes to the winery and we destem by hand, which sounds a very slow process, but no, actually, you know, with this piece of wood, this wooden box we've had made, the grapes are kind of massaged over this piece of wood with holes in, and they drop into, generally, we don't destem directly into the quavery.
No.
Because the mouth is quite small. So we destem into a big plastic tub, and then by bucket, we fill the quavery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we fill it not 100% full, because you've got to have some room for the heat and for the fermentation to move. And the fermentation is wonderful. The quavery gives the chance for the wine to have a good temperature regulation. It seems to always have a good chance to combine the sugars it's converting to alcohol in with the flavors, in with the tannins. We choose not to do any movement, any pigeage or remontage. We just leave the grapes there.
Okay. For how long?
The smallest amount of time we've done about for the for red wines is about 2-3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The longest we've done is 6 months.
Okay.
Traditionally, the quavery in Georgia, the maceration, the long maceration is with white. We don't have a lot of white grapes, and originally we had the big 2,000 litre quaveri, so we decided let's do it with red.
Yeah.
And that was definitely my husband's idea. Eric, he said, you know, let's do it with one of the few. Let's to do a long maceration with red in clay. And we love the results. We thought it gave the wine a tension, a purity, very expressive of the vineyard, even in a hot year.
But then you, I mean, the first quavery, then you open it and you remove the skins and move it to a smaller one, or do the skins go into the next one as well?
No, what we do is after we've decided we've extracted enough tannin and the wine has sort of a balance to it, you know, after the fermentation is finished, we close the quavery completely. So we put a big lava stone that we've had made, this lid, and we seal it, and then we can taste it from time to time. But when we decide it's reach the extraction that we want, initially by a scoop and then by a bucket, we empty the quavery into the press. We physically have to get into the quavery because, you know, it's very far down. We could use a pump, but we try not to use pumps at that stage. You know, we're wanting to do everything by hand rather than any mechanical chance to turn the grapes into a mush. Then we press the wines, and the new wine goes back into a smaller quavery, so without the skins. And there, it's important, the wine is quite turbid. It's important that the wine spends at least another minimum 4 or 5 months, sometimes a year, sometimes now even a couple of years, to settle out.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not ending up with, you know, a wine that's completely turbid in bottle.
No. And why did you decide to use this method from starters? I mean,
it was the first was a gift.
Okay, the first was a gift.
And Eric was in, my husband was in Georgia looking for some Georgian wines to import into the UK. He went to a beautiful monastery and was talking with the monks there and the bishop there and saying, you know, the Georgians are very much, you know, what's happening with the family. And he said, oh, you know, my wife and I, we've started this small project on Etna and working with old vines. And so during an evening, they decided to give us a gift of 2 cuvées.
Yes.
So no, it wasn't something, you know, we sought and thought, let's make wine in Quavery, and we weren't sure whether it would work with Nerello Mascalese, but after the 2012 harvest, we then went back to Georgia ourselves and sought, you know, who's the best Quavery maker, and it took several years to receive all the Quaveries we now have.
How many do you have in total?
We have 9.
9, okay.
Yeah.
If you compare with oak, it adds a lot of flavors to, or it can add a lot of flavor to the wine.
Yes.
Because the cuvée has any particular flavors that it adds to wine, except for, you know, the tension. And
yes, hopefully there is no flavor. Well, I don't think there's any flavor. Some people, you know, now are starting to say, oh, I can tell that's made in cuvée. But, you know, in the end, it is lined with beeswax and it's meant to be a neutral vessel.
Yeah.
The key thing is it's buried underground. And so I think for temperature exchange, it's very good. But it's a kind of, it's a closed system. So whereabouts wood, it breathes and there's, you know, it's porous and it's, you know, with the air and there's sort of an exchange with the oxygen. Even if it's an old barrel, that can still happen.
Yeah.
Whereabouts the cuvée being underground and sort of the shape, the whole thing doesn't have that chance.
No.
And yes, there's a different texture to the wines because of the cuvée. And I think that's very much to do with the shape of the cuvée.
Okay.
The way the wine moves in the cuvée is different to wood, is different to some of the ceramic and clay eggs that are out there. People say it moves in more of a vortex shape. And, you know, it has a different effect depending on, you know, what's happening with the planets and the sun and the star constellations.
It's a whole science.
Exactly.
Whole
science,
yeah. But have you only tried Nerello Mascalese, or have you done it with the other grape varieties as well?
The vineyards, when we pick them, we pick the vineyards as a
as
vineyard.
A whole, okay,
so there's always a little bit of Capuccio and a little bit of Alicante. And the Quavery wines we haven't done with our lower vineyards at 700 meters that are generally more fertile, producing bigger volumes. We select, it needs to have a certain acidity and attention naturally in the grapes. So we've worked out, you know, around for us personally, around about 900 meters, the vineyards we have 900 meters to 1,000 meters, have a tannin material and naturally a finesse in the grapes that can enable us to do a long maceration. Because if the grapes originally don't have all of that material, there's no point macerating.
You're not
going to get anything.
No.
For us, it's not really a grape variety thing. We pick the vineyard as a whole.
I see. Yeah.
And white, we're yet to do an experiment only because we've only just received the smaller cuvées and we have a very small quantity of white. So we ferment that in stainless steel and a beautiful wooden foudre that we have. Whether we do a white fermentation, I would like to. Eric's not quite so convinced. And I don't know whether it will work that well with our grapes.
Okay.
We're not sure, but if you don't do the experiment, you never know.
Try.
So,
hopefully
soon, yes, I'll get a chance to do that.
Yeah.
So, what's the future for Vino di Anna? Do you have any?
Hopefully, long.
Yeah.
I mean, we're at the start of our journey,
yeah.
And the fact that you know, we would like to stay probably almost at the size we are now.
Yeah.
We're making around about 40,000 bottles. We've grown exponentially. Quickly, but we've realized that, you know, it's meant to be Eric and I, you know, pruning and in the winery, and then of course we have to sell and market our wines. We're very lucky. We have 3 young guys that live locally that are very much part of Vino di Anna, and they're like our older sons.
Okay.
Our actual sons are, you know, 5 and 7, and so we hope for them. They love being part of it. They think they're going to, you know, take over the domain. They already have their vineyards named after them. They're already quite, you know, presenting the wines and talking about it. So hopefully, but whether one ends up being, you know, surfing in Bali and the other, you know, into fashion, who knows? But
hopefully,
ideally, Vino Diana, you know, there's someone one day that says, ah, that's my grandma and grandpa's domain that they started.
What are your biggest markets right now? Is it mainly Sicily itself, or is it other parts of the world?
No, actually, quite interesting. We're only really just starting to sell our wine locally.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite different from other wines made on Etna. And to be honest, in the beginning, it was not well received by people. They didn't, you know, the Palmento, yes, but some of the other wines were, I suppose, lighter than they're expecting, higher in acidity.
Mm.
They don't have a very high VA, but for some people, yes, they're a little bit wild. So straight away, you know, we work very well in the States and all over the States with a fantastic importer called Indie Wineries.
Mm-hmm.
Japan from the very beginning.
Cool.
And a little guy in Belgium were probably the three markets we started with. Now definitely Sweden is very important with wine trade. But we have the fortune to sell our wines in 16 different countries now.
Oh. Okay,
purely through contacts. Yeah. Yeah, for the amount of wine we make and purely we want to travel. We want to, you know, to hang out with people in different countries. So that's been one of the choices. Instead of just focusing on a few markets, we decide, okay, well, you know, it'd be quite nice to get to know this country, those people. They're quite cool. Let's, you know, see if we can sell some wine and hang out. So
it's the right way to go.
Yes,
definitely.
And if we talk a little bit more general about Sicily and Etna, what do you say? What is happening in Sicily and Etna right now? What are the main movements according to you?
Okay, well, I think Sicily, you know, for a long time, it was just a huge quantity of wine was made, but by people like Planeta, but on the other side of the island. And sort of so in the southeast and around Trapani. And, you know, Sicily was well known on the international markets for Merlot, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, sort of varietals at a low price point, but, you know, fresh and fruity. Etna, 20 years ago, there weren't even five people that put their wines in bottle. Everything was sold as bulk. And, you know, it was either sold in Calabria to beef up, you know, the wines in Calabria or in the north of Italy. It even came to France. Now there's over 100 different people putting wine in bottle. So it's, you know, poor choice of words, but it's kind of been an explosion in the market just even in the past 15 years. So Etna seems to be, you know, everyone wants to have Etna on their wine list wherever you go. That's not to say it's all great wine and great winemaking. I think, you know, people on Etna have a long way to, and this is my personal opinion, you know, to understand the vineyards, to understand the grape variety, and hopefully make farm more organically rather than use chemicals, let the wine ferment naturally instead of adding yeast and sort of all the other tricks of the trade that are out there. So, yeah, it's interesting, the different expressions of wines that are there. But I think there's room for growth, and there's room for some more, you know, a winemaking family of people to come together rather than people just making their wines in someone else's winery, putting a label on it, and then, you know, selling it. It'd be nice for there to be some more proper vignerons, you know, a vigneron that actually has the vineyards, owns the vineyards, you know, farms it, and then makes the wine in their tiny little cellar.
That's very cool. I like that idea too. It's nice when.
Well, it exists in many other regions, and particularly in France, this vigneron idea. It's, you know, this compared to, you know, I've got some money and as a hobby farm, you know, a hobby on my sides, you know, let's get someone to make a wine. So, you know, I can say I do this.
There's much more pride in that as well.
Yes, I think so. And I think the wines are more expressive. You know, there's less touch of a hand of a winemaker. There's more expression of that vineyard and the place. So I think, you know, that it'll be interesting to see where these producers and where all these labels go.
Yeah. So it's really interesting time now because you can get a lot of really high quality wines from Sicily and in comparison with other places of the world for not that much money. As well, being said,
and great
that's,
value.
that's nice for the restaurants as definitely. Well to play with and work with. And,
yes, but I think the wines are very expensive from Etna as well. It's expensive farming, you know, particularly if you've taken on old vines that have to be farmed by hand.
Sure.
Or these terraces. So, you know, the equivalent of what you can get from the Loire for, you know, 2, 3, 4 euros, ex cellar. It's impossible to do that on Etna. You have to start, you know, basically the wines for a minimum of what your production costs are 6, 7 euro. So then, you know, it makes sense that for people to, if they're living off making the wine, they have to come out with, you know, minimum from the cellar, wines that starting at 10, going up to 15. And, you know, that's crazy when you go to somewhere like New York and you suddenly see bottles of wine, you know, for hundreds of US dollars. Next to something from France, which I think is really delicious and has, you know, generations of, you know, history, and it's for a fifth of the price.
I just realized, because we have three bottles in front of us, so we're going to put up a picture on the Acast app, of course. We've talked about the Palmento and the Cuvée, and we also have the Vino di Anna Vino Rosso.
Yes.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, so we have two Vino di Anna Rosso. We have one that's actually a different label to that, which is 100% whole bunch and a vinification in wood for 6 weeks. We don't make that every year. It seems every this one vineyard, only every 3 or 4 years, the bunches are perfect, and we can do that long whole bunch vinification. The Jeux de Quinze that we have, Jeux de Quinze stands for Thursday the 15th, which is meant to be Thursday the 15th of October. Normally, that's the date we harvest this one vineyard.
Okay.
It was in 2009, and Eric, being French, we always had just referred to that on our sample bottle, Jeux de Quinze, to remember what the cuvée was. And so this comes from one particular vineyard at Monte La Guardia, which is a little bit higher than where the estate is, just over 800 meters. It's about, I'd say, 90% Nerello Mascalese. Maybe the other 10, most of it's Nerello Cappuccio. And we ferment that wine always in a wooden fermenter that is open. It's a big fermenter, 30 hectolitres. And there's about 20-30% whole bunch.
Okay.
And the rest destem by hand. And so we want a little bit of pristine fruit, a little bit of lift from the whole bunch. It's darker in colour than the Palmento, a bit more structured, a bit more acidity. And so, yeah, that wine spends a week in the wooden fermenter. We foot plunge it once or twice just to release some juice, and then press it, and it finishes fermentation in stainless steel. So since 2009 we've been making the Jeux de Quinze.
Cool.
So is it a wine that you think is supposedly, the Palmento is supposed to drink quite young?
Yes.
And the Jeux de Quinze is more like to put in a cellar, or?
No, actually, at the Palmento, I think, you know, within the year, you know, it's generally that's meant to be. I mean, that said, you know, you can drink it sort of 2 years, even 3 years, when we're not quite too sure. It's always fascinating to see how they're evolving. The Jeux de Quinze a little bit more, as it's got a bit more tannin, and often the first sort of 6 months, it's quite fruity, but quite austere in the palate. So yes, you're right. After a year, I think now it's really, that's the 215 in front of us. And I think its moment is now.
Yeah.
Whereabouts the Cuvée wine, it's very much got its own life and energy. And so it has moments where it's very closed. Then after a while, it can become quite floral. Then it can become sort of, you know, quite savory in characteristic as it ages. So definitely that needs more time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea is to make also wines that are very good with food. The Palmento is fun just to have a glass if you're having, you know, a salad or sitting outside. Whereabouts definitely the Cuvée and the other Cuvée wines we make from individual vineyards, you know, they're much more, you know, structured and more complex in layers. So great food wines.
Well, Anna, thanks a lot for taking the time talking to us and our listeners. And
I think you have inspired many people to,
to
travel
to
Etna.
Oh, fabulous. I'm always so promoting holidays to Etna. Come and see us. So thank you both very much. It's been lovely to meet you.
Lovely to taste your wines as well. So.
I wait for you on Etna.
At the moment,
if you come, bring skis. There's lots of snow.
We're used to that. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay.
Anna. Thanks.
Nice to meet you.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.